listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont author Alec Hastings, whose new book, Otter St. Ange and the Bootleggers, a rollicking adventure for all ages. Alec Hastings lives in Vermont's Hill Country, where he has been a teacher, storyteller, and woodsman for many years. Otter St. Ange and the Bootleggers, A Tale of Adventure, is his first novel. On the eve of Vermont's Great Flood of 1927, rain falls on northern Lake Champlain. Otter St. Ange's father has been missing since World War I, and then a letter arrives with surprising news. Royal St. Ange may be alive. Otter and Granddad load a canoe with Missisquoi Moonbeam and paddle across Goose Bay to rendezvous at the family camp. But Otter's father is nowhere to be found, and bullet holes scar the cabin walls. The trail finally leads to a cutthroat gang called the Crows, who will kill every member of Royal's family unless Otter can stop them. In reading this new novel by Alec Hastings, I was always mindful of the oral tradition of storytelling, even though Alec Hastings has placed his stories on the page. So I asked him about the tradition of storytelling in his own life and how that may have influenced his presentation of this book.
My family told a lot of stories, not only my family, but all the people that I lived near. There's a stereotype of the Yankee as being a laconic, taciturn character, but that was not the reality that I grew up with in the 1950s in central Vermont. I grew up near Woodstock, Vermont, near a little village called Tassville, where there's a covered bridge.
Uh-huh.
And I used to go to the farm next door on a daily basis for many years, and at night, when Elmer Bumps was milking the cows, one of my great joys was to sit nearby once I'd done my chores and listen to him tell stories.
Oh, great.
And my grandfather was a storyteller. I remember, I actually mentioned this in the book, I lived with my grandparents and my parents for the first few years. And probably when I was five or six, I used to hear my uncle's car drive in the yard, and I knew there would be storytelling around the kitchen table, so I would sneak down the back stairs and sit on the last step, sometimes with my younger brother, and we would listen until we were caught, and my mother would give us a little spank and send us back upstairs. But I loved to hear the clink of glasses out there. I wasn't quite sure what they were drinking at that time, but I'm sure it's something that lubricated the storytelling. And then they would launch into these stories, and I just remember some hilarious escapades that, you know, we probably wouldn't have heard about under normal circumstances. My grandfather once got a hold of some dynamite, which was easier to come by in those days. People blew tree stumps with them and so on. And for a July 4th prank, he touched off some dynamite above, I think it was above the town of Newberry, but the ledge that he was on ran under Main Street, and so he ended up cracking some of the plate glass windows in the storefronts downtown.
So, I guess that's funny now. Maybe it wasn't so funny back then.
I don't think it was funny to him right afterward, because he was caught.
Oh my gosh.
As I remember the story. But anyway, I did grow up with a lot of storytellers, and that is something that, you know, piqued my interest in stories from an early age.
Now, is that why you wrote the book? I mean, do you think that those stories have been building inside of you and wanting to be a book for a long time?
Yes, I think so. There was that that early time, the magical time of childhood when stories could be the ones that I heard recounted by my father and grandfather and my black sheep uncle, and the stories that were read from a book at bedtime. And I was still pretty young when my parents would bring us along to the Norman Williams Public Library in Woodstock, and they would go out of that library with an armful of books, and we boys, I had two brothers, and we would go into the children's section, and I was soon loading up with The Adventures of Freddy the Pig and whatever else, and then a little later it was Tarzan and Robin Hood and then Treasure Island and Kidnapped. So that was just, those stories are vivid for me, and I think some of my favorite stories are still stories of adventure, like those stories that I read as a kid.
Yeah.
Then as a teenager, I learned about more sophisticated tastes, and I was reading Russian novels when I was in high school, like The Idiot by Dostoevsky and
yeah.
Crime and Punishment, and for a long time, I became very interested in that kind of reading and that more complex story. But later when I came to write a story myself, I went back to those stories that I loved as a kid, and that's what I wanted to do, write that kind of story.
Now, you mentioned a minute ago the adventures and that you loved to read, and this is described as a rollicking adventure in your introduction, and a boy is the hero, Otter Saint-Ange. And I'm just wondering how you chose Otter to be your hero or your narrator. And then I wondered if we could just talk a little bit about the role of adventures for boys. You did talk about that a little bit as to your own reading tastes, but just like boys loving adventures.
Yes. Well, Otter is, I guess, what we writers call, and now I can include myself in the we instead of saying they, I suppose.
Yeah.
He's a composite character. One of my favorite characters of all time is Huck Finn, and he's pretty much a real person for me.
Yeah.
I read The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and then Huck Finn as a boy, and I went back to Huck Finn later. I've read it a few times, and I just love Huckleberry Finn. I love his literal mindedness. He takes things at face value, and he thinks that Tom Sawyer is really a kid, that, you know, his shenanigans with playing pirates and robbers and that kind of thing is for kids. And Huck, because of his, you know, his father who is a drunk and a mother who isn't there, grows up pretty early and pretty young. And I have a sense of that from my grandfather's side of the family. My grandfather ran away from home, I believe, when he was 11 years old, and then became a teamster for the Connecticut Valley Lumber Company when he was 14, hauling logs out of the woods on those river drives back in the early 1900s. So I loved Huck Finn, and when I was trying to figure out what kind of story I wanted to write and decided I wanted to go back and write one of those adventure stories for boys, part of that was because I was teaching by that time, and I had a lot of boys in school who I found that there were a lot of stories for younger boys, for boys in 5th or 6th grade, 8, 9, 10 years old, but not as many books for boys 11, 12, 13, 14, certainly 16, 18, I felt there was a gap, so I wanted to try and write a novel for those boys.
Mm-hmm.
And so Otter is a little bit Huck Finn, is a little bit a student I had in class whose picture is actually on the cover of the book. That pen and ink color watercolor wash on the cover is from a photo taken of two of my students and an old friend from Randolph, and then I don't know. I guess every boy in an adventure story that I've grown to love, that is heroic, that is coming to that age where he's thinking about his own courage. And I guess this is where you wanted me to talk about adventure stories for boys. I think that one of the things that all boys think about is how to take the measure of their own courage. You know, how far are they willing to go? Will I jump off that bridge when all my peers are daring me to do it? And so on. And, you know, most of us, when we grow up, we realize how stupid that can be. But boys, you know, are looking at the men that they've known in their lives and the stories they've read, the movies they've seen, and they know that somehow a man's courage is part of, you know, the question that he has to think about.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess that's how I ended up writing that kind of a story for boys.
Yeah. I was going to ask, before we move far past this subject, what do you teach and what ages do you teach now?
I teach English to high school students. I teach in a small town. Bethel, Vermont, is one of the few small high schools left in Vermont. And I teach 10th, 11th, and 12th grades.
Okay. Yeah. And then, so also I wanted to just touch on something else you said, which you were talking about your own grandfather. And I love, one thing that I just love about Otter St. Ange and the Bootleggers, which is the name of your book, is that Otter's grandfather is part of the adventure. He's a very strong character. He's a main character, but he's also strong and smart, and he's just a fantastic grandfather figure. And I find that sort of unusual. I don't remember seeing a grandfather in an adventure story like this for kids, but I think it's great that he's so important. So I wondered if he's based on your grandfather. It sounds like maybe he is a little bit. And how you decided that you would include a grandfather figure.
Good question. I like that. I hear a lot of, I've heard a lot of feedback about the book and different people. This is one of the things that I love about stories. Different people like different parts of a story, just as I do. I did have a grandfather I respected a lot and that I grew up with. He was a pretty stern figure for me when I was a boy. It was my younger brother, really, that got along well with him and spent a lot of time with him. But I got to know my grandfather later in life after I married and had children, and I grew to respect him even more. I never quite understood how difficult his life had been as a boy. He didn't get along with his own father that well, and that's why he ran away from home. And he was a very strong person to make his own way in the world at the age of 14, 15, 16. So, yes, I think the strength and the courage that Granddad has, he's a formidable character, and I think some of that comes from the model of my own grandfather.
Yeah.
Some of it is I read this story to friends in a writer's group over a period of years. It took about 6 years. And a couple people remarked on the fact that he was they questioned whether he really, if his character was right for a backwoods person, if a woodsman would have read Shakespeare or the Bible, and, you know, whether he would be quite as intelligent, I guess, as he was. And and my answer to that was that idea of a rural person being ignorant or unsophisticated is a stereotype.
Yeah.
And I've known many hill people, rural people, who have been very intelligent and also very well read, some of them. And back in those days, in the early 1900s, certainly most homes had a Bible, and many of the people who could read, who were literate, would know Shakespeare. And so that's one of the things I like about his character, too, that he is a backwoodsman. He's a woodsman, but he is also an intelligent and fairly well-educated person.
Now, I wanted to ask you about the characters' names. So you have Otter, which is obviously an interesting name, Too Tall, Boyce, Angus, and then some sort of more normal girls' names, Evelyn and Mary, and then the French names, Richelieu and Lenoir. So how did you choose your characters' names? Where do you go to find interesting names, or do you kind of just come up with them?
let's see, I'll give some examples. Otter just came to me. I knew that the story was going to take place on Lake Champlain. That's a place where I've spent a lot of time paddling a kayak and a canoe. And so I wanted a playful character and one who is very comfortable in the water and on the water. And
yeah.
So the animal just popped into mind. I thought that would be a good name for that character. And St. Ange is a fairly common name in northwestern Vermont. I'd seen it when I worked up there from time to time. So I just like the ring of the, you know, two names together. Too Tall was the name of a character that I heard about years ago, lived in a town where I lived. It was just a nickname for a guy who was very tall. and I always liked the nickname. So I think, like a lot of writers, I don't necessarily keep a writer's notebook, but I do have a pretty good memory, and at least I used to. So that one stuck with me. And some of those other names, Mary, for instance, who's a very important character in the story. It's a very simple name, but I love the name, and I've known some sweet women named Mary. My dad wrote a book that was a collection of children's jump rope rhymes collected in Vermont, and the title of the book was Miss Mary Mack,
yeah.
Which is mentioned in connection with that character in the book. So there's an origin there.
Yeah.
So a lot of the names, you know, are just sort of picked out of thin air, and some of them are names I've remembered or just like, and there you go.
Okay, great.
Corbin Lenoir's name has a little bit more to it. A Corby in Welsh is a crow, and Lenoir in French is of the night.
Oh.
And he is a
dark,
rather dark,
dark character. Yeah. I have a question about him at the end of our interview. So how have your students reacted to the book?
My students have enjoyed the book. I used them as guinea pigs, actually, for 2 years while I was in the final phases of putting the story together. I was far enough ahead so that I could read to them in installments. We have a half-hour time after lunch every day where students go to classrooms and read.
Mm-hmm.
The teachers call it DEAR, drop everything and read. Some of the students call it drop everything and rest. But not everyone loves books to the same degree. But I went to them at the beginning of the year a couple years ago and said, if you do a pretty good job during the week, I would be happy to read to you on Friday if that's something you would like. And they all said, yes. It's amazing how much older students like to be read to. You know, we usually think of little kids being read to, but if it's framed in the right way, teenagers actually love to hear a story.
Yeah.
So I started reading the book chapter by chapter, and I said, you know, if you don't like it, I don't want to force you. I was trying to think of a book that would appeal to a wide range of ages, because in that group I had seventh graders to juniors.
Yeah.
So, 11 or 12 up to 17, whatever, and girls and boys. And so I started reading this, and I said, you know, if you're not interested and you'd rather read your own book, just go ahead and read your own book. Or if everyone, you know, if I see your eyes glazing over, I will find something else. But they got very interested in it. And as time went by, you know, you can tell when you're standing up in front of a crowd of people, all the talking would disappear, and they'd be looking at me and following the story and asking me about it later. So I had very good feedback from the kids.
Oh, that's great. And did you ask them for input about the actual plot and events, or did you?
I did. I just said, you know, if, every once in a while after I was done reading, I'd say, well, what do you think? You know, is this working? Do you have any suggestions? You know, is there anything I'm missing here? And so, you know, most of them said, oh, you know, it's great. We love it, actually. But once in a while, somebody would mention something. I remember one kid had a phenomenal memory, and he, you know, a couple times he would point out things, that little loose threads that I needed to tie up, which was great.
Oh, that's fun. And they must have enjoyed being involved in that, too.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
So actually, speaking of reading to them, I'm wondering if you can read a couple pages now for the benefit of the listeners so that we can get a sense of the book.
Sure. This is from a chapter called Muff's Wild Ride. It's chapter 7, so it's well into the book. And I don't know if I need to introduce too much. It'll just be a chance to get a sense of the language and the rhythms of the novel. So here we go.
Okay.
Too Tall was at my heels, and maybe Mary and Granddad were close behind, but I never looked back. I didn't bother to sneak out one of the service entrances either. I raced down the hall. And when I reached the central staircase, I jumped on the banister and slid down to the lobby like my namesake on the banks of the Missisquoi. Too Tall bounded down after me. A portly man in a dark suit with a black trilby pushed back on his forehead was sitting on a sofa reading a newspaper. His mouth dropped open in amazement as we streaked by. He started up, stuttering and indignant, but we were already gone by the time he asked what we thought we were doing. "Detective," I said to Too Tall. He nodded. We took the porch steps, three at a time, and raced down the walk toward the lake. A gray shape flashed past me, and Jake took the lead. Then we heard more shots. "Come on," I said, "run." Then, scared for Dad, I sprinted ahead. Too Tall warned me to be careful, but I was too out of breath to reply. I left him behind, and I ran until my lungs were exploding. When I got to the landing, I heard a sharp crack and saw a muzzle flash from where Louis had hidden, and then answering gunfire from the torpedo. I called to Jake and then dropped into a slide and landed behind some wooden barrels, like Babe Ruth stealing third base. We hid there until the men on Dad's boat started shooting at Louis again, and then I ran full tilt to the Simon Weed. I dove from the dock and somersaulted onto the boat as a bullet whistled over my head. Jake leaped aboard right beside me as more shots were fired, and I heard a rumble I didn't recognize at first. It was the engine of the torpedo. Jumpin' John Henry, I thought. Somebody bottled a hurricane when they built that engine. But how had Chance started the torpedo? Somebody must have put the coil wire back. One of Chance's men, a stocky fella but wicked short, suddenly appeared near the bow and untied the torpedo's painter from a cleat. Then he scuttered along the dock to untie the stern line, which was right across from my hiding place. I still had the Babe's bat in my hand, and when he reached the other rope, I flung it. I hit the poor little duffer spang on the noggin. He looked at me, stunned, and I ducked as he dropped in a heap. Someone fired from the torpedo as it drew away from the pier, and bullets splintered the woodwork where my head had been a second before. "Stay down," yelled Louis. "They've got an automatic rifle." Lord love a duck, I thought. This is getting serious.
Thank you for reading that. That's,
you're welcome.
That's a great section. There's so, you know, so much action and so much going on. And you mentioned the Babe and the Babe's bat. And it is fun that Babe Ruth is actually a character in this book briefly. And I wondered actually if you could talk about creating a character from history. What was real and what was invented about the Babe Ruth that you presented briefly on the page?
Well, all right. What was real? I told my students this morning as they were writing journal entries, I give them prompts in the morning to do about a 5-minute quick write.
Oh, great.
And I always tell them a quick little anecdote so that, you know, if I'm asking them to do it, then I do it. So I embellished my anecdote this morning. It was basically a true story, but not all. And at the end, I confessed that, and then I said, don't ever let the truth stand in the way of a good story. So that is my watchword, or my philosophy in working with historical fiction. My accent is on the fiction and not the history. But it is true that Babe Ruth frequented the Hotel Champlain in the 1900s, and he went there to play golf. I did a little research throughout many parts of the book. I read about the Great Flu epidemic and about World War One and so on. And I read about the hotel and Simon Weed, the man who built it. And so the Babe went there, and then everything else, the Babe's girlfriend and, you know, the personality of the Babe as I recreated it was my own invention, although I did read a biography of the Babe also before I did that chapter.
Great. And I was going to ask you about the research for this book. There's an awful lot that you must have had to either know about or research further, like just the period of time. This takes place right after Vermont's Great Flood of 1927. It is during World War One. You knew a lot about the battles, and you talked about the battles that Otter's father had been a part of. And then bootlegging, of course, is part of the title, Otter St. Ange and the Bootleggers. So you had to probably do some research on bootlegging on Lake Champlain. So were you just always online and in the library, or what did you do?
Well, I didn't have to go to the library as much because of the miracle of the modern world and the cyber history you can find.
Yeah.
I did spend quite a bit of time, and sometimes I was tempted to be annoyed, but I had so much fun in being sidetracked that I really enjoyed the historical part. I'm not really a research scholar by any means. My father was, but I would just be writing along, and then I'd realize, well, I'm going to have them go to Plattsburgh, and they're going to go, I actually remembered the Hotel Champlain from when I paddled on the lake and remembered that big building. And at one point or another, I guess I learned that it wasn't always a Clinton Community College. I guess I got curious and found out that it was at one time a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, that would be a great place to have something happen. So then, I just thought, if I'm going to give this verisimilitude, I'm going to make it authentic, then I need to learn a little bit more about it. So I looked up the Clinton Historical Society online. They've got information about that hotel. And that was a lot of fun. I bought several books. I bought Robert Creamer's biography of the Babe. I bought another gentleman's history of the Battle of Vimy Ridge. I bought the Great Influenza Epidemic. I learned about the orphan trains.
Mm-hmm.
And I got sidetracked many a day, and that's probably why it took 6 years. but it was a lot of fun to do that.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, and the rum running, I got Scott Wheeler's book, Rum Runners and Revenuers or something like that. And he had quite a few anecdotes about bootlegging in northern Vermont.
Now, is that because we're a border state? I mean, is that why the bootlegging was so prevalent here? I know Smuggler's Notch has also got a history of being a place that people would cross over the border to either smuggle various things or, I think, an escape route, too, for the Underground Railroad. But
We had a lot of smuggling here, yes, because we were on the border, but I think mainly we had a lot of smuggling because they were smuggling everywhere in the United States.
Okay, just because of prohibition.
Half the population teetotaled and half the population didn't, and those that didn't weren't about to be told they couldn't, that they couldn't drink. So, and I have stories from my own family about this. But I know that in the early days of Prohibition, a lot of people, the governor of New York, for instance, did not take it seriously at all. And I think he posted something like 6 state troopers on the northern New York border, and they have a lot more border than we do. And so there was a lot of liquor, a lot of alcohol coming across the border. And there was a lot coming across the Vermont border on Champlain and through the woods here and there. I remember one story about bootleggers who, I don't know, I think this was up near the Averill area, I don't remember, but there was a man who trained some pack horses so that he would send them across from the Canadian border on their own. And I guess, there was a lead horse who knew the way, and then the others were tied to each other, and they were packed with bottles of whiskey, and they'd show up on the other side to his to meet with his partner in crime, and that guy would unload them and sell them and send the horses back to Canada, and they just kept them going back and forth like that until the law finally caught up with them.
Wow. That's great. Now, you mentioned being being a paddler on the lake, and I wondered how much of the geography of the lake you already knew and how much you had to study that.
Yeah, I knew a lot about the geography of the lake, at least, you know, what you know from the cockpit of a kayak or from a seat in a canoe. I've always loved the water ever since I was a kid. My dad always had canoes, and I've always loved the stories about the, you know, the colonial period and the Native Americans, the Indians here, the Abenaki, and the settlers who, you know, used the rivers as their highway, as their highways. And my wife and I set out from South Bay on the very southern end of Champlain near Whitehall. Mm-hmm. Years and years and years ago, I guess it was probably back in the 90s, and paddled the length of Champlain. And we spent many, many overnights and weekends and afternoons paddling on various parts of the lake. So I got very familiar with almost all the lake. You know, I can't think of too many places that I haven't paddled by or been very close to on Champlain. So I knew it well from that experience. And then I've always been a lover of maps, and when I was writing the book, I'd go and refresh my memory by looking at a map.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to be sure that my book had a map in the beginning.
Now, I was curious if Bill's Hole in the Wall was based on a real place, or did you make up some of these little places?
I did make up some, yes. That's made up.
Okay.
Providence is a pretty big island, and like a lot of islands on Champlain, it has, you know, part of it is a high bluff, and then it slopes down on the other side to a more gentle meeting with the lake. But it wouldn't be surprising to find that kind of a spot on the lake, because that sedimentary rock often can be hollowed out by the waves to form a little pocket or a little slot that's hidden by cedar bushes or cedar trees.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So at the beginning of the book, when we start reading the book, Otter is living with his grandparents. His father is missing. He was away at the war, but they want to find him. They think he's back. They don't know what's happened to him. And his mother has passed away. She was a victim of the influenza. So early on the book, I'm not giving too much away, but early in the book, he does find his father, and he's waited so long to find his father. I found this to be an emotional scene, and I wondered if it was emotional for you writing that scene.
Yeah, that's another good question. When I wanted to write this book, I had the idea for the character Otter in the 1990s, so that's a, you know, good while ago, 15 years or so ago, maybe a little more, and I just could not get started. I wrote a few short stories with Otter as a character, and I wrote several versions of a first chapter,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't get going. I tried first person, I tried third person, and I had listen to other people. Of course, I always went to writers' conferences, and I belonged to a writers' group, and occasionally I'd meet another writer, and that writer would say, you know, some people would say, you've got to have an outline for your novel before you start. And I was that kind of person. I thought, okay, if I know A, B, C, and D, then I can do this. And then other people would say, well, you know, if you have character, that character will speak to you, and you know, you let that character do what they need to do, and then that character will lead you where the story's going. And you don't have to think about all of it ahead of time. You don't have to know it all ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hear that, and I would say to myself, yeah, I would say to that person, oh, that's interesting. And then I would say to myself, a cartoon bubble over my head, really?
No way.
Not believing that, but I have to confess that is eventually what happened. I realized if I was ever going to write the book, that I needed to get the canoe in the water and get the characters paddling and set out. Mm. And that's what I did. And then these characters became real to me. And talking about the father in the story, I'm not one to really psychoanalyze the artist and, you know, the origins of all these things, but my father died in the 90s, and it wasn't too long after that I came up with an idea to write a story about a boy in search of his father. So mm-hmm. maybe there was a link there, maybe not, I don't know. But it certainly was, I found that what this person said about your characters is really true. Otter became like a real person to me. Mm-hmm. And Royal became like a real person to me. And when they discover, you know, when they find each other, and when Otter finds his father, and that short time afterward when they're sitting on the porch at that cottage, it made it easier to write because it wasn't about thinking, it was about feeling.
Yeah, yeah. And it came across in the scene. I think that's why I asked the question. It comes across in the scene that it was not just an intellectual thing to write. You know, it was heartfelt. So, do you mind if I read just a tiny section of the book and then we can talk about it?
I'd love it.
Okay. This is soon after he finds his father, which actually, now that I'm looking at it, is farther into the book than I said. But anyway... this is when they tell Otter's father that his wife is dead. I'm going to just read a couple paragraphs here. Let's see. This is Grandfather speaking. "I don't know how to tell you this, Royal. Sweet is gone. She was up in Halifax, Nova Scotia, just after the war, when the troop ships were bringing the boys home. She caught the Spanish flu and passed away." "Why did she go to Halifax?" asked Dad. Granddad looked away for a moment and then turned back to Dad. "She was looking for you," he said. Dad didn't answer. He blew out the kerosene lantern and left us all in the shadows. Granddad sat down with Dad and me. We gazed into the darkness where the waves of the lake rolled toward us. When they met the shore, they said, "Hush, hush." The rain drummed on the porch roof, and I felt troubled, like I had at the Hotel Champlain. I thought maybe the rain was bad luck, that it was building toward a misfortune, but maybe I was just worried about Dad. We sat like that for a long time and didn't speak. The coming dawn sorted itself into shades of gray, into shapes that almost looked like things we knew. Trees appeared and disappeared in the mist like ghosts. We glimpsed a dark bird passing the mouth of the cove, flying fast, a cormorant probably. Its wing beats whispered to us in a dark language. Still, no one said a word. Finally, so slowly I wasn't even sure when it happened, a gray light snuck around from the east side of the island. It was weak, no match for the rain, and the endless stretch of cloud that hung low over the lake, but it signaled the dawn. The limbo of darkness and silence lifted. A new day was begun. Dad rose from his chair. I loved this. It really stood out to me because I think it takes a little bit of courage to put a sad scene like this into a rollicking adventure. And I thought it was beautifully written. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about managing the change of tone and shifting in and then back out of it again.
Well, thanks. I that was exactly the passage that I was thinking about when you talked about Otter's father, about Royal, about the two of them meeting.
Oh, okay.
And I a couple things. One is, I think I've started this whole novel writing process pretty late in life. I'm about to turn 62. And I think anybody that, by the time you're in your 40s, for some of us, sadly, it happens earlier. But for most of us, by the time we hit our 40s or 50s, we've experienced some big loss. Mm-hmm. You know, someone that we love passes away. And that happened for me in the 90s when I was right around 50. My dad passed away. My wife passed away. Mm-hmm. And I think that coming to that passage was, you know, I think that with what Royal has been through, mm-hmm. he's literally been through the war.
Right.
And Otter hasn't had an easy time of it either. He's been well taken care of by his grandparents, but he's lost, you know, he had lost both his parents. And so there's joy in this meeting, but there's also some things to reckon with, and this news for Royal is just terrible, terrible news. And, you know, I had experienced that same news in my own life, and so I think, as I said, it was the feeling that came out and not the thinking.
Yeah, right.
And and it translated into, I think men are, these men at least, I think it's true to who they are that they would sit on the porch and not talk.
Yeah.
At this point.
I think you can say men. I think that's okay.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know about all men, but,
right.
but these men at least. You know, they would find solace in silence in each other's company without talking. And I think for the reader, seeing through their eyes, seeing the mist and the rain that is a kind of a backbeat in this story, it, you know, it just allows them to sit with that sadness for a little while, and they need that to honor it, to feel the truth of it, and then to go on.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I thought it really came across. And I think what you're mentioning about what they're watching, you know, watching nature, watching the birds and the mist, I thought that helped sort of with the change of tone. It kind of took us from an intellectual place to a more emotional place and then back out of it again. And yeah, it was really nice.
That sounds right.
A little while ago, you mentioned the cover art, that it was a pen and ink drawing. Is that what you said? It was a pen and ink drawing?
Yes.
And who did that?
Carrie Cook is a book designer I met through the League of Vermont Writers. She's been designing books and illustrating books and creating covers for over 30 years. She actually did the book design for Peter Miller's A Lifetime of Vermont People, I think is the title of his new book.
Okay.
Beautiful, beautiful book of his photographs. And she is a wonderful graphic artist.
Wonderful. And did you give her a photograph?
I did.
Okay.
I went to the Sandbar State Park just before Christmas last year, right about this time. And it was in the 20 minutes we had before snow started flying, we got a couple of pictures my daughter-in-law took. And then I took those photos, one of those photos, to Carrie, and she did a pen and ink drawing, and then a watercolor wash, and that is the cover.
Wonderful. And then you've got some great blurbs on the back of the book. You've got Howard Frank Mosher, Rusty DeWeese, George Woodard, and Natalie Kinsey Warnock. So how did you go about asking, did you know these people, or did you just approach them?
I did not, but they're all very kind and generous people. You know, Howard Mosher, to me, is the king of Vermont writers. He's a hero, a literary hero for me. I love his work, and I just wrote to him, and he kindly agreed to put something on the back cover, and it was real, very touching for me, because one of my father's books, my father's first book, Goodbye Highland Yankee, also has a blurb from Howard on that book. And if you look at Vermont books, there are so many with Howard's name on them. So
he is so generous. You know, I had him on the show once, and I actually I met him at his home and interviewed him in his kitchen. And every surface was covered with manuscripts from other people. It was amazing. I said, "What are all these books?" He said, "Oh, these are all the books people have asked me to read." I was like, "Oh my God."
I believe it. Well, I hope he doesn't have to read all of them all the way through, but he is a kind man. Howard probably won't remember this, but the first time I met him was at Bear Pond Books when they were across the street in Montpelier from where they are now. They were where I think Rivendell was for a while. Anyway, I went into there when I first discovered Disappearances. A friend of mine was reading the book, and I walked right back to the M's. I walked by the clerk at the counter and by this other person, customer in the store, and I looked in the M's. I couldn't find Disappearances, and I ran up and to the person behind the counter. I said, "Do you have a book by Howard Mosier? It's called Disappearances." And she said, "Yes, I do. In fact, there's a whole stack of them right behind you, and the author is standing there beside them if you'd like to say hello." So I had a nice visit with Howard and bought his book, and that was my first meeting with Mr. Mosier.
Oh, that's great. I want to clarify what I said about his kitchen. He was not going to read all those manuscripts, and you should feel honored that he did read yours, because I don't think he reads even, I mean, I think he is a very generous guy, but I think he gets thousands. So
yeah, who could possibly do it?
Right, exactly. So the other thing I wanted to ask you, the book is, it's a beautiful presentation. It's made very well, and I see that you published it through the public press. I just wondered if you could talk briefly about your publishing experience.
Sure. It's publishing nowadays, if you're a writer, I guess you know this, at least if you've tried to publish, it's a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And I started a few years before I actually finished the book. I finished the book right before Irene came to Vermont, like 2 weeks before Irene came, which was an interesting coincidence given that it takes place during the 27 flood.
Right.
Anyway, I met Carrie at one of these League of Vermont Writers meetings. I talked with various writers about the whole publishing reality, and I learned that because of online publishing, that the traditional world of publishing had been turned on its head, and that New York City publishers, some of whom had been thriving companies, were, really having very tight profit margins and having to cut employees and so on and so forth. So a few years ago, just about the time the book was ready to be published, I went to the League of Vermont Writers Summer Meeting where there were some literary agents, three agents from New York, and I got to pitch the book to all three. And two of them were in their 30s, I would guess. And, the first thing anybody wants to know is, how would you describe your book? Is it a detective story? Is it a romance? Is it young adult fiction and so on and so forth? And I have a hard time describing my book. I think it's a little bit of historical fiction. There's a little romance in there. I guess it's mainly an adventure story. I had been thinking of young adults when I wrote it, boys especially, but I found that the girls in my classes loved it as well, and I found people as old as 94 reading it and enjoying it. So one of the agents said to me, "Well, your main character is 18. He can't be 18. You've got to change that, make him 14 if you want this to be a young adult novel." And I said, "Okay." But I didn't have any intention of changing, but I just listened to what she had to say. And my novel is not the typical young adult novel. It does not take place in an urban setting, where most of them do, or in a futuristic setting like the Hunger Games.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have any electronic media in it. And so it's a little bit off the beaten track.
Mm-hmm.
One of the agents in her 40s had two sons, and she did ask me to send her a chapter. I did. She sent it back. She said, "This has got to move a little bit faster. Try and cut some material so that you get to the action, and don't slow down your action." And I sent it back to her, and I never heard back from her.
Hmm.
So I thought at the age of 60, I guess I was 60, 61 at that point, I didn't have too much time to wait, J.K. Rowling had quite a few rejections, I think, mm-hmm. before she got Harry Potter published, and Catherine Stockett, who wrote The Help.
Oh, right,
she had
right.
a number of rejections, and I just didn't figure I could wait too long. You know, I could be 70 before anybody published the thing, and who knows if I'd last that long. So I just thought, I didn't have any, you know, great, grandiose schemes for making this a national bestseller. I wasn't going to retire on, you know, the profits of Otter St. Ange and the Bootleggers, but I did want to get it out to Vermont readers. I have loved growing up here in Vermont. I love this country. I love this place. And I just thought there were a lot of Vermonters who would enjoy this story, and, you know, hopefully others as well. And so I thought, I want a publisher I can talk to. And I looked around my area, and I learned about Stephen Morris. He had this small press called the Public Press, and I liked his mission statement. I read it online, and I went to visit with him, and we agreed to, you know, do it together. And so that's that story.
And it was a good experience?
Yes.
Great.
Yeah. I don't know, Stephen said to me a number of times, I think you're going to find this a lot of work. What I also heard about traditional publishers now is it's a lot of work with them because they can't afford to push the books of more than just a few authors that they can predict will be successful.
Mm-hmm.
They might take a couple of new ones here and there that they really feel pretty sure about, and they'll push their work. Otherwise, you've got to pound the pavement yourself. And that's what I've had to do. I've had to try and contact, other writers, newspapers, anyone I could to try and publicize the book.
Mm-hmm.
But it gets easier because you meet people and word spreads, and then you get really good responses from some people, which I've had. And yes, it's been some work, but it's actually been a lot of fun. It's been, in many ways, kind of a treat after some of the hard work of sitting down at a computer for hours and hours and hours, years. It's been fun to talk to people about it. I've met some really interesting people.
And are bookstores open to readings for you and stuff, or do you have to? How do you deal with that?
That, I think, comes later in the process. If there's someone else there who, like me, is trying to get some recognition of your work, my first step was to try and contact newspapers. And newspapers are always looking for news, and they'll often meet with an aspiring artist and make it a human interest story of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
The Valley News did that kindly for me, and the Herald and Randolph, which is my hometown. And then as a few more people read it, I went to a lot of people events over the summer. I went to Tuesday Night Live in Johnson, where often, I don't know, probably 300 people would congregate next to the elementary school to listen to bluegrass music on a Tuesday night. I went there just to hear some music, and then I came back a few more times just to sit with a little table and some books and sell some books and talk to people.
Oh, what a good idea.
Yeah.
Did you have to get permission to do something like that?
Yeah. I checked with the town, and it's different for every town. They said, just come ahead. Yeah, that's fine.
Oh,
sounds
great.
Like a nice thing to do. And so it's kind of like being a politician. You try and get out and meet a lot of people. But I enjoy talking to people, and eventually you start to gain a little ground, and word spreads, and people become interested.
Okay, wonderful. We're running out of time, so I want to just ask you one more question, I think, Alec. And that is, for writers, I wonder if you have any advice about writing villains. We've talked before about Lenoir, and he's your dark guy. Can you talk a little bit about writing villains?
Sure. Well, the kind of villain you create depends on the kind of story you're writing. And for me, Corbin Lenoir is a villain. He is not a three-dimensional character. This is not a deep world-class novel like, you know, the Russian novels. Corbin is bad through and through.
Okay.
And if you're writing that kind of novel, a genre novel, then make him bad and have fun with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, but make him interesting.
Yeah.
If you're going to make him bad, make him bad in a particular way. I think Corbin is definitely a bit of a two-dimensional villain, but he's distinguishable from other villains.
Right.
When you meet him in a bomb crater in World War I and he's cutting the finger off a German soldier to get the ring, you know, to sell later, you know Corbin is bad.
Yeah.
If you're writing a bad character, a villain, in a more complicated novel, perhaps like the story of Edgar Sawtelle, then that character is going to have good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
But the bad is eventually going to tip the balance and... And at the same time, he's got to be a unique character as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a great answer. So, Alec, I want to just re-mention the name of the book. It's Otter Saint-Ange and the Bootleggers, A Tale of Adventure by Alec Hastings, published by the Public Press. Alec, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It was really fun.
Thank you, Shayla. It really was fun. I enjoyed it very much.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Alec Hastings. His new book, again, is Otter Saint-Ange and the Bootleggers, A Rollicking Adventure for All Ages. You can learn more about his work at his Facebook page, facebook.com/ottersaint.ange. And that's spelled saint, S-T, dot, O-N-G-E. Rate the Book and the Radiator are supported in part by Battery Street Jeans, where vintage and recycled clothing come together through love. Happy days. Located at 7 Marble Avenue, the south end of Burlington. For more information, check out batterystreetjeans.com. And by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world. Internet, television, telephone, burlingtontelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic network. This week I have two Write the Book prompts, generously suggested by my guest, Alec Hastings. In his classes, Alec offers his students prompts for their twice-a-week journal entries. He says, quote, "I supplement the prompt with an anecdote that helps them see how even one word can be spun into many. For instance, before Thanksgiving, I gave table as a prompt. After letting my students give me blank stares for a moment or two, I launched into a description of my grandmother's kitchen, the cast iron cook stove with the hot water reservoir, the wood box, the bench with the lid that lifted and allowed boot storage beneath, the basketball-sized cookie jar shaped and painted like a ripe red apple, the fresh-baked bread and cookies that awaited us every day when my brothers and I returned home from school, the oaken clawfoot table upon which meals were eaten and around which we gathered for conversation, dessert, and many a colorful tale, and not least of all, my grandmother, the heart of the kitchen and the source of the good smells, the good cheer, and the grandmotherly love that enfolded us all." On the day that I spoke with Alec, he had offered his students the prompt, "Scary Experience." So there you are. You can consider the word table with all of Alec's explanation, or you can consider the expression "scary experience," or you can write about both. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.